Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of the day for the 3rd of Adar. And today we're going to talk about a response with the Tzitz Eliezer from volume 19, response number 42. And Tzitz Eliezer was the head of like a higher Beit Din in Israel, so that there would be hard cases that would come to him, and he was like also a court of appeals. He had other members of his Beit Din. So he's writing to a Beit Din that's had a situation. And the situation is a reminder that even when law works out correctly eventually, the process can itself be difficult and problematic for litigants. And I think it's important to remember, not saying people don't, I'm just saying we don't always think about it, about the human cost of the time of litigation, of how long it takes for things to happen. That itself can be a problem as well. So in this case, it's going to be a big issue that comes up, and we'll see it. You have a husband and wife, a man and a woman, who got divorced. And then they return to living together. Now, they're not observant. We're going to get to that. That's going to be a relevant consideration here. But they return to living together. And the woman got pregnant. And she had a daughter. And then after some time, the man made a party. Whatever the party was about. It sounds like it might have been a party to celebrate the birth of the girl. But he made a party. And he claims that at this party, he married her. Meaning, he claims he gave her a ring. And he said the words, "Ariat Mekudeshli Batibadzu," that you are, you know, betrothed to me with this ring, and that there were witnesses who saw it, and therefore that they're married again. And he's not willing to divorce her. So she doesn't want to live with him. It's unclear when exactly that happened, but she has broken up with him. She's not living with him anymore. She doesn't want to live with him anymore. And he is keeping her and claiming that she can't marry anybody else. And the Rabbanut is not willing to give her permission to marry somebody else until they clarify this situation. This has been a continuing issue that's going on here. So this says there are two issues that we have to clear up. One issue is that Gemara says if a man divorces a woman and then we see them sleep together, we don't physically see them sleep together, we see them sleep in the same room together in an inn or in a hotel or something. We see them sort of living together, as it were. Gemara says we assume that that was a remarriage. Because of Ein Adam Oseh Be'ilato Be'ilat Znut. Because when people have relations, they don't intend them to be promiscuous and not for the purpose of marriage. They intend them to be for the purpose of marriage. Now that's going to be an example, and we've seen this in other tshuvot. I think I wrote one up that appeared on TorahMusings.com. Of a question of when the Gemara makes an assumption about what people do or don't do, and how people do or don't react to certain situations, do we think of those claims by the Gemara to be as being universal, all people at all times would react in this way, or do we think that the Gemara means it for the people of that time, and for people in general, but that there could be exceptions to that, or there could be other ways to look at those situations sometimes? So that becomes an issue here as well. There are extremists on either side of that. There are those who will say, oh, whenever the Gemara says that, it only means it as a reflection of the time in which it lived, and that's all it is. Those will say, no, it's always timeless and universal. It applies to every single person. Neither one of those necessarily is the complete truth. So here, that's one question. Question number one is, we saw them living together. Since we saw them living together, does that mean that they have returned to marriage necessarily? Because so she would need a full get, and he's refusing to give a get. You enter into that protocol of life where there's a man who should be divorcing his wife and refuses to, and what do you do about that? The second question is, let's say we don't think that's true. Let's say we think that the living together does not itself make them remarried. Maybe the husband's, we have to believe or worry about the husband's claim that at this party, he in fact married her. So let's start with the second one first, I think, because it's easier to dispense with. So in the second one, he says, the husband claims that he said to three men at this wedding, at this party, he said to three men at this celebration, I want you to be witnesses. And then he said to them, in front of them, he said, Hare amakudesh ali kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. You are betrothed to me like, you know, the laws of, or like the religion of, Moses and Israel. Now, if she accepts the ring from him, if he gave her a ring in that situation, and there were witnesses, that would be marriage. Right? The whole idea that you need a wedding, and you need a rabbi, and you need a minyan, those are all later issues that come up, and they're important. But as a technical, right, the level, it's not clear that that wouldn't be a marriage, and therefore we would require her to get a get. Now, then he says, the husband, when he's telling us this, says, oh, and two of the witnesses were Shomrei Shabbat, were Sabbath observers. He wants to say that because he already knows a little bit that maybe non-Sabbath observers don't count as witnesses. That's a question as well that we've seen on other occasions. I can't remember right now what it was, but we saw somebody who said that even if we treat non-observant Jews, that doesn't mean they can give testimony. So this guy seems to understand that lack of observance could be a problem for them to give it to be serving as witnesses. So he says, well, two of them were Shomrei Shabbat. Problem is, at least one of those was a relative of his, and therefore could not give testimony. What's called a Sheni B'Sheni. The way that we figure out relationships in Halacha is that if you're related directly, let's say a father, son, or brothers, those are called Rishon B'Rishon. They're one to one. And then if it's separated a little bit, then it would be one. It would be a Sheni. So let's say a nephew and an uncle would be a Sheni B'Rishon, because the uncle is like in that first generation and the nephew's in the second generation. So a first cousin then would be a Sheni B'Sheni because they're in the second generation. So Sheni B'Sheni, we hold this Pasul Eidus, cannot give testimony on behalf of the relative, and therefore that person can't be a witness. And that, for that reason, that guy didn't show up to Beit Din because he knew his relative. So his being there doesn't mean anything. Then we also found out that another one of the witnesses is not Shomer Shabbat. He says that about himself. But now you might not believe it about himself. Because we have another principle in Halacha, Ein Adam Me'isim Atzmo Rasha, that we're not allowed to be, we don't trust people to self-incriminate. So a man comes to court and says, I don't keep Shabbat, that's self-incriminating, because he's saying that he's violating the Torah in a very serious way, so we wouldn't believe that. But you can easily find out, and in this case, there was somebody else was saying about him, yeah, he doesn't keep Shabbat. So Tzitzit Yosef says, we don't have to look into that anymore, the truth is, because what he gives us testimony makes it clear that he's not a good witness. Meaning, let's say we don't know that he's not observant. Let's say we have to assume that he's observant. It doesn't matter if you look at the protocol, meaning the court proceedings that are given. Meaning, if he's a court of appeals to Eliezer, he doesn't have everybody come to him. Like court of appeals, he gets the proceedings of the first case and he gets asked about it. So he tells us those proceedings are dated the 11th of Iyar of Tafshin Mem Tet. The 11th of Iyar of 1989. And he's writing this the 3rd of Adar of Tafshin Nun Aleph, which means it's a year and three quarters later. So this woman has already been sitting around for a year and three quarters while her case sort of slowly winds its way through the courts. So probably what happens is, at the 11th of Iyar, you had the court proceeding. The judges take time to think about it. Then they write it up. Then she figures out what she's going to do. Then maybe she appeals to them. Maybe not. Maybe that. I don't know. But it's people's lives, you know, and I think that's something that's very important to think about. People's lives, not their lives as in life and death, but their lives as in how you spend your life. This is a woman now who has spent a year and a half of her life changed to somebody, and that comes up in monetary cases as well. I think it's an important thing to think about. If you're a small business and you have a court proceeding against somebody and they have deep pockets, just the fact that would take, you know, if they owe you $10,000 and it takes you 3 years to collect on it, so that's a problem because your business might not be able to function without that $10,000, and it puts you in just, meaning when they pay you back eventually, they'll pay you the $10,000, but all these years you suffer without it. So theoretically you could say we could charge them a fine or interest or some such a thing. Interest is a problem in Halakha, but let's say we could charge them extra. But that's only good, it only helps you if you manage to keep your business going all that time. So I didn't mention it at all, and maybe therefore I'm editorializing in a way that I shouldn't, and if you don't like that, I apologize. You can certainly feel free to let me know. My email is grothst@gmail.com. But I think it's an issue that we should be thinking about carefully in terms of our court structure when we think about it. So if it doesn't affect us, we sort of try not to think about it. But you have here a system, and this is an Eretz Yisrael where they're trying to keep the world going, and yet, you know, you have this woman just sitting around waiting. So from 1989 to 1991, she was waiting around. In any case, if you look there in the proceedings, he says, it's clear that this witness is a liar. Why is it clear that this witness is a liar? Because his first testimony was, they bring him to the Beit Din, and the husband is apparently there, and he says, I don't remember if the husband said anything to the woman. Right? And I don't remember if he gave her anything. Right? They say, what happened in the party between this man and this woman? He says, I don't remember. I don't remember if he gave her anything. I don't remember. And then the husband whispers in his ear, the man, we don't know if he's a husband. The man whispers in his ear, and then he says, oh, yes, I remember now. He told he was being Mekadesher, but I don't remember if he gave her anything. And then when they ask him another question, he says, oh, he gave him a ring. And the lies involved were clear to everybody, meaning that there's a judge there, that Tzitzit says, who laughed about it and said, first he didn't know anything, and then after these leading questions from the husband, he changes his mind. So Tzitzit says it's clear that you don't have to accept that testimony. It's not testimony, and we don't have to get into the question of whether he's observant or not, whether that makes him not an invalid witness or not. So that's an important reminder to me, and I wasn't sure that Batei didn't do this, and this was something the courts felt comfortable doing, but it's an important reminder that just because somebody gives a testimony that I can't actually impeach doesn't mean that as a judge you have to accept it. In this case, he never actually did anything that we can prove is a lie. Came in, he said, I don't remember that anything happened. And then he says, oh wait, no, he gave her this, and oh wait, no, he gave her this. So he's never lied, he's never contradicted himself fully, and yet, since Elias says, it should have been clear to everybody that he's not a valid witness because he's just saying what the husband is telling him to say, and therefore he shouldn't count. So that leaves the question of the other witness, right? So far we've gotten rid of one witness because he was a relative, one witness because he was obviously lying. We have one last witness. So Tzitzit first says, by the way, even let's say this witness gave perfectly valid testimony, we had to believe everything that he said, and as far as we knew, he was telling the exact truth. The Shulchan Aruch paskins in heaven is there that if somebody performs kiddushin in front of one witness, that's not kiddushin. We need witnesses. It's called in Torah learning parlance, they call it edut l'kiyum hadavar. It's not testimony. Sometimes testimony is only for the purpose of verifying something. So, for example, if I came into court, if somebody dragged me to court and said, you owe me $100, and I said, yes, I owe $100. It's unclear why I would have dragged me to court, but let's say they dragged me into court, said, you owe me $100, I said, yes, I owe $100. The court wouldn't say, do you have witnesses? Why wouldn't they say that? Because I've agreed. So in many, many situations in halakha, if the two parties agree as to what happened, then we just trust them and we don't require witnesses. When it comes to kiddushin, it's not true. When it comes to marriage, it's untrue. So that if a young man and woman or an old man and woman came to us and said, I married her, and we say, what happened? He says, we were, you know, alone together on the beach, and I gave her a ring, and I said, Haram Kudesh Ali, you are betrothed to me, Kedam Moshev Yisrael, and she accepted it, and she says, yes, and here's the ring, and it's so beautiful, and that's what happened. That doesn't create Kiddushin. Kiddushin requires a dut l'kiyum hadavar, and therefore, if the Shulchan Aruch Pasuk, there's only one witness, even if the two of them agree, they're not married. Now, the Ramah mentions there that there are those who are machmir, there are those who say that one witness could be good enough if the two of them agree. So we can't get into that now. It's not sort of central to this tshuva, but the Ramah is basically saying that we think that one witness has some validity in halacha, and therefore, or the Yesh Machmir say that. Those who are stringent about this say that there's some validity to witnesses in halacha, to one witness in halacha, and if the two of them agree, then we'll accept that, and that's good enough to establish it. But to the Ezer, but where one of them is denying, I mean, the woman is saying it never happened. So the woman is denying it, then you don't have to worry about it. As the Ramah said, and the Ramah also adds there, that if it's a place of igun, if it's a place where we're worried that she won't ever be able to get married again for whatever reason, so for example, the Ramah's case could easily have been, let's say two people got, you have one witness says two people got married, the woman denies that it happened, and the man has now by now disappeared, and we can't find him. So we can't find him means he might have died. He might, so we can't get him, and she's an aguna, she can't get married. So the Ramah says in those situations, we rely on the opinions that say that if there's only one witness, that cannot establish a valid marriage. And so in our case, says the Tzitzit Ezer, and here's where the big reveal happens, it's clearly a place of igun, because this woman is meugenet kvar ketisha shanim. It's 9 years. So I go back to what I said before. The Tzitzit Ezer does make a big deal of it. He uses it as a leniency to say that we don't have to care about the fact that one witness says they got married. But still, got to think about this. And it happens it happens too often. And it's not only in the case of women and divorce. It happens there, but it happens in lots of things as well. And it's something that people should keep in mind as we try to move our way towards a better world, a perfected world, a world that's worthy of the coming of Mashiach. We need to focus on things like this as well, and we need to work hard to make sure that our courts and our Rabbanim and our system functions in such a way that people get the justice they need and they get the results that they should be getting, they deserve to be getting, with all possible speed. So, here, why is she an aguna? Because the man is demanding of her money, right? Excessive money that she can't possibly pay. Meaning, and this I'm not condoning or promoting this, but I think it would be true, even in Israel today, that if the man asks for what the judge considered what's called a reasonable amount of money, ransom is never reasonable, but a reasonable amount, they would just say, you know what, we're going to have a hard time with this, there's all these halakhic complications, there are halakhic complications, so we recommend to you just pay him the money. But here she can't, and he's asking for excessive money, so this is going to go on to say, even if his testimony was valid, right? It wouldn't have been. We could still tell her she doesn't have to get married. She doesn't have to worry about this marriage. Now, notice this. Imagine if after 9 years, she says, you know what? It was never a marriage. You're allowed to go get married again because it was never a marriage. So for 9 years, you've been stuck in what wasn't a marriage. That means theoretically, and I'm not promoting this either, but theoretically, had she gotten married to somebody else right away, right? We would have now found out that it was okay that she did that because she was never married to the first guy. But it took her 9 years because, anyway, complicated issues. So this points out, and he says, and I said all this, if his testimony was clearly fully valid, because in fact, if you look at what he says in his testimony, it's also not so clear, because he, at the beginning he says, oh yes, there was Kiddushin, but then he, this witness, said, but we didn't take it seriously. We thought it was like a joke, it was like playing around. And he didn't mention a ring at all. And then the court said to him, what did he say to her when he gave her the ring? So they threw in the ring part. And then he says, well, it was really loud. He put the ring on her finger, but it was like late sunnas. It was like a joking around. It was fun. It wasn't anything. So then the court again said to him, what did he say? He said, I don't remember that he said anything. And then, I'm sorry, the court said to him, what did he say to her? And he answered, I heard him mumbling. But he didn't know what. So the Beit Din again asked, what do you know exactly? And he says, he told us that he was being Mekadesh her. I'm sorry, the Beit Din said, what do you know exactly? Did he tell you he was being Mekadesh her? And the guy says, maybe, could be. And then the Beit Din, is like they're completely leading. They're giving him all the information he needs to know. They said, did he tell you that he was being Mekadesh her before he gave her the ring? And then the witness said, I don't know. Right, so this is, you just read this back and forth, and you know that this isn't testimony that has any validity. He didn't see anything. He didn't hear anything. And anything that he saw, and he was like changing his story all the time, according to the questions of the court. So when there are no witnesses, there's certainly no kiddushin. Right? Two people come into court and say they had kiddushin, but there were no witnesses there. It doesn't count. It's not kiddushin. So that's the first part of it. So it turns out, this is letting us know that it turns out that from that perspective, they weren't married. Now, what about the other part? If people were married once upon a time, and then they started living together again, do we say, in a double study, that's no, people don't just engage in random promiscuous sex, and therefore they're married again, and she needs a get? So this is, he looks into it, he says he doesn't think so. He thinks you don't have to worry about that either, and the reason is, first off, many poskim, he says, say that people live together in sin. So what does in sin mean? It means we know that there's something sinful about their living together. An easy example would be if this is a woman who doesn't regularly go to mikvah. So if the woman doesn't regularly go to mikvah, then it means that this is a couple that doesn't care about halacha. Another possibility is if the husband is what's called parutz ba'arayot. He is sexually promiscuous. He does sexually wrong things other than this. So then, if that's true, we don't have a chazaka on him anymore. Meaning, says the many poskim hold, the kol ki haygav the lo ne'emra chazakazu. This chazaka, this idea that men won't engage in random and in promiscuous sex, and therefore if they have sex with somebody, they mean to marry that person. And that whole claim, that whole chazaka, that whole assumption wasn't for the kinds of people who would live together without the woman going to mikvah, or who are generally not careful about their sexuality, their sexual activity, and therefore she shouldn't need to get. So he quotes a Pirkei Tshuva in Evan Ezer, the name of the Ravid, and the Rivash, and there's a Shut Maharit, etc. Now there are those who disagree, but again, since it's a question of Igun, says Ezer, we have the room to be so many, we have the room to rely on those who held that way. So that's step number one in this question, right? When the Gemara says we assume about somebody something, do we always say it's true? Or do we say that was in certain circumstances, but not in other circumstances? Here it's a case of, there are those who held this particular chazakah, this particular assumption, was made in certain circumstances, not in others. So too, he says, I saw it in the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan says, Davar Pashut, it's obvious that this whole idea that in Adam Sebi Latubi, that's it, that men don't engage in promiscuous sex and they intend to get married by virtue, is only, he says, when this particular act doesn't have an Avera to it, doesn't have a sin to it. So for example, if she's a Nida, if she hasn't gone to mikvah, so in this act, he's violating an Isser Kari. He's violating a prohibition that the Torah says leads the Kari to being cut off from the Jewish people. So if a man is in the middle of doing something that leads to him being cut off from the Jewish people, then there's no reason to think that he's making sure to be married for it. So too, says the Aruch HaShulchan. Now, I have to say, not that this brings it up, but I say on that one, I can imagine somebody arguing, well, he doesn't know, right, because he's a tinok shenish, but he's not observing, he grew up in a non-observant home, he doesn't know that having relations with a woman where she hasn't gone to mikvah is an iser kares, but he knows about marriage. Theoretically, I could argue, somebody arguing that the presumption of the people intend to get married when they have relations with a woman is still in force, even for somebody who's willing to violate the Torah, because they don't know that they're violating the Torah. Next piece in the Aruch HaShulchan says, "V'chein yeshlo ata isha acheret." If he has another wife in a place where polygyny, where having more than one wife is not accepted, right? So almost all Western countries for hundreds of years have not allowed having two wives. So if he's having a second wife, so the Aruch HaShulchan says, then you see he doesn't care about marriage, the institution of marriage. The institution of marriage in a country, in a culture, where you can't have two wives is you only have one relationship with one woman at a time. But if you have a man who's going to, he's taking on two women or more at the same time, then it's clear he doesn't have that thing, and therefore, once again, we don't have to fight. Then the Aruch HaShulchan closes by saying, but now this would say that if she herself is not specifically prohibited to him for some reason, then you should get to have a get. So this says it shows you, he doesn't think you really need a get, he only thinks you need it because it's a Qumrah and it's better. And that would mean then, in a situation where you have a problem and the husband's not willing, meaning if this couple had come to him and the husband makes his claims and they're clearly splitting up, the husband says, I'll do whatever you tell me to do, we would tell him write a get just in case. And the fact that she couldn't marry a Kohen after that, that's life, she couldn't marry a Kohen after that, but she was already divorced once, so it doesn't matter, right? So that's not an issue for us. So we would have. But here in this situation, he's refusing to write the get, so therefore, he thinks you go by the Ikar Hadin, by the essential halach, and the essential halach is she doesn't need a get. More than that, in this situation, we know that she didn't go to mikvah, they agree. He was parut ba'arayot. Parut ba'arayot means, in this situation, he was promiscuous, he had, because he had another wife. Or she wasn't a wife, he had another woman that he lived with. And he would sometimes have relations with one in front of the other, meaning he was a bad guy in the sense that he and this woman are living together, they have a child together, and he brought his mistress home, basically. Right? She was, you know, his mistress, because he's living with one woman, he brings her home and has her live in the house too while he has relations with her. Maybe not in public, not in a room, but, right? So that's a problem. And then they have a report from a doctor in Beilinson Hospital who says that this man is afflicted with chronic paranoid schizophrenia. Right? So it means that he can do various things and he doesn't care about what he does, and his sense of morality is not the same as our sense of morality, and that can condition our sense of whether or not he would or wouldn't have promiscuous relations and relations where he had no intention of getting married. I'm not sure if it's appropriate for me to say this, but I'll just mention that I always find it interesting how men like that find women. And here you have a guy who's been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. He marries a woman, divorces her, starts living with her again, then refuses to give her a get, and yet he wasn't before that a perfect guy, and all of a sudden he went crazy, and yet he had another woman, and he lived with the second woman in front of the first woman. I don't know why people put up with these kinds of people. They seem to get away with this stuff in life, and I don't know how this works. Anyway, that's just perhaps a problem of mine. But the Tzitzis says, so therefore he thinks you don't need, that you can assume that when they were living together, it was not in fact for the purpose of marriage, and especially since there's an Igun question here, he's abandoning her and she has no way out of it, and therefore he thinks it's okay. Then he adds a very interesting claim that he thinks is valuable, it's interesting to think about it. He says, the man came into court saying two things. The man came into court saying only one thing. He said, we got married at that party. Still, as it says, from the fact that he told you he got married at that party, now we already spoke about the fact that the way he handled it and the proof he had for it says he didn't get married at that party, but he thought he got married at that party. So as it says, the fact that he points to that as the proof that they were married shows you that all the time that they lived together, he didn't mean his acts of living together to be acts of kiddushin, meaning halakhically, theoretically, a man can be mekadesh a woman. Today we do it with a ring. But halakhically, I mean, we don't do it anymore, but halakhically, if a couple lives together for kiddushin, she's mekudeshet, right? So they go to a hotel room and he says, I want to be, there are two witnesses standing outside the door, he says, I mean, mekadesh this woman with this act. That also works. So The fact that he pointed to the ring giving at this party shows you that he did not intend those acts of intercourse, those acts of marital relations, to be marital ones. And it's also true that he never went to a rabbi, which in the state of Israel is where you go. It's like it's the government functionary that you go to for a marriage, which shows he didn't mean it to be anything official, right? He just lived together. We lived together, and whoever knew about it, but it wasn't anything that he was like trying to make it into an official thing. So he thinks that proves that there was no Kiddushin either from the fact that they were living together all this time. And then he says, and by the way, the Shagas Aryeh, who lived in the 1700s, in his first tshuva, had something else very radical also. He said the whole idea of Ein Adam Oseh Bilato Bilatznut. So until now we've said if people live together in sin, meaning that she doesn't go to mikvah, and things like that. But the Shagas Aryeh had claimed that the whole principle of Ein Adam Oseh Bilato Bilatznut only applies in times when people knew, when there were some people who had Kiddushin by Bia, who had Kiddushin by the couple living together. Meaning, in our times, you never heard of such a thing, right? Can you imagine you went to a wedding? I'm not in favor of this, but imagine you went to a wedding and they said, okay, couple's going to get betrothed, they're going to have the Kiddushin ceremony, and they go into a room, right? Okay, come back in a few months or a year, which is what they used to do in the olden days, and we'll have the Nisuin ceremony as well, and then they'll be fully married. So it's just not done anymore. Nobody does it. So Shagas Aryeh says, once you live in a world where nobody does it that way, so it turns out that nobody knows about that halacha. If you said to most random, you know, not well-educated people, how do men and women, Jewish men and women get married, the answer, get men have their first stage of marriage, the answer is, you give a ring. They wouldn't know, for example, that you give a shtar, you give a document that says, you're going to do this to me with this shtar, with this document, and they certainly wouldn't know that you could do it with bia, with the act of sexual intercourse. So the Shagas Aryeh already says that if somebody doesn't know it's a possibility to create a marriage by this marital act, there's no reason for us to say he wouldn't have done it promiscuously, he meant it to be marriage, because he doesn't even know that it's a possibility for marriage. It says the Shagas Aryeh, in fact, halavai, it would be great if most of the rabbanim of our time knew the halachos of Kiddushin in the proper way, but certainly regular people don't do it. So the Tzitzit says, so that's even more so about our guy. So from all that, he says that she doesn't need a get, and not for either of the reasons, and she can go get married, and she should not think of herself as Mu'ugenet anymore, and we can hope that she can build a new home among the Jewish people. And that's the Tzitzit. That's a very important Tzitzit, very important ideas about marriage and not marriage, and chaining women and not chaining women that come up. And we'll stop here. That'll be a tshuva day for the 3rd of Adar. The Tzitzit of the Ezra telling us about a time and location where a woman who had been stuck and imprisoned in what turned out not to be marriage was finally freed and allowed to go off. And we can hope that nobody else will be imprisoned when they shouldn't be, or will be unfree whenever they should be free. Have a great day.